Welcome to NetLab Spotlight. Today I will be decoding neural representations of words within phrases with Miriam Honari, Brie Schwenard, Esti Blanco Elorrieta, and Alona Fish. So I want you to imagine that you're in a furniture store and the sales clerk asks you, "What are you looking for?" And you say, "A white lamp." What are the neural processes that occur before your mouth actually starts articulating a white lamp? Obviously, your brain has to somehow access the representations of white and lamp, and somehow those representations play together in order to form that composed representation. And then finally, you actually articulate that expression. So in this research that we're going to talk about today, we asked the question of exactly how do those representations of white and lamp play together right before you actually start articulating. And to investigate that, in a controlled way, we used a picture naming paradigm. So instead of a subject going into a furniture store, we presented them with pictures of colored objects and then measured the neural activity using magnetoencephalography, our typical technique, MEG, such that the measurement starts at the onset of the picture and then goes on all the way until you start speaking. So in several prior studies, we've investigated what neural signals are enhanced by the presence of composition during such planning. So do we see increases in neural activity at any time point during the period of time when you go from the picture onset to articulation onset, where the act of composing a complex structure like white lamp shows up as an elevated neural signal as compared to, say, planning, say, a single word or even just a list of two words. And we have several studies sort of addressing and answering that question. But here we asked a different and, in a sense, a harder question, which is exactly what is the kind of livelihood or activation of the individual word representations as you are combining them. So for example, as I'm planning to say white lamp, is the time course of activation of the say noun representation or the adjective representation different from if I was just planning to say the color adjective by itself or the noun by itself? And the really critical component of this particular study was that we actually managed to have a control condition that was non-combinatory that nevertheless had subjects producing an adjective and a noun. So basically the same kind of color adjective and then a noun. And we created that by showing the subjects pictures, pictures of colored objects where the background also had a color, so it was on a colored background. So for example, you would have a white lamp on a green background. And so then in the non-combinatory list condition that nevertheless had you producing an adjective and a noun, you actually named the background and then the object name. So you would say green lamp. And although that involves the production of an adjective and the production of a noun, it really isn't combinatory in the same way. So this study had two main findings. One of them was that noun representations were simply more decodable than adjective representations. So kind of across the board, noun representations seemed more consistent or more robust in such a way that it just resulted in better decodability. Second, when you're planning a phrase, so that phrasal condition, noun representations seem to persist across time in a way that adjective representations did not. So we had specific types of noun representations active early on in the epoch. So let's just say like around 100 milliseconds after picture onset. Those representations stayed active and kind of reemerged a little bit later in a way that we did not see for adjectives. So one way to think about it is that you activate a certain kind of semantic representation early on in the epoch, and then you actually perform some computation with that representation. And interestingly, that's not something that we saw for the adjectives. So those are the two main findings, but then of course they raise lots of questions, which is something that we discuss in the conversation. So this is a collaboration with Alona Fish's group at the University of Alberta in Edmonton, Canada, where she's a professor of computing science and psychology. But we actually started the work together when she was still on the faculty at the University of Victoria. And there, the main student author working on this project was Mariam Hanari. And then when Alona moved to Edmonton, to the University of Alberta, her postdoc, Bree Chouinard, became kind of the lead author. So Mariam and Bree have joint first authorship on this study. And then the third author is Esti Blanco Elorieta, who is actually a PhD student who just graduated from my lab less than a year ago. But at the time of this work, she was actually an RA in Abu Dhabi, in our Abu Dhabi lab. So she actually kind of way back when collected this data set. And so I didn't quite trust myself to be able to moderate a Zoom conversation between the five of us. And so what I did is that I asked all the junior authors to prepare sort of audio segments and introductions of themselves. And so we're going to start with those. And then Alona and I will have kind of a more long form conversation about kind of our history and this project after those introductions. So we're going to start with Mariam Hanari, and then it's going to be Bree, and then Esti, kind of in the order as it is in the paper.
My name is Mariam Hanari. I grew up in Iran and moved to Canada for my master's. My background is in computer science. I was always interested in intelligence and its definition, and I find human language a very fascinating aspect of intelligence. It's very exciting that we communicate so much information with so little in terms of vocabulary and time. During this project, I was an RA in Dr. Fish's lab, applying machine learning methods and computational models of language to decode brain signals. In my current role, I use machine learning and reinforcement learning agents to learn new behaviors in video games, or essentially it can be any simulation environment. During my master's, we came across the data of this project collected by NELLAB and found it very compelling for our decoding analysis. For the language production task in this experiment, participants have to say the adjective first, followed by the noun. However, we observed a high decodability of nouns as early as 400 milliseconds, much earlier than the rise in adjective decodability. I find it very interesting aspect of the result, especially for English, which is an adjective noun language. In some other languages, such as Persian, noun comes first and then it's open to describe with as many as adjectives as the speaker wants. So for example, a little old blue cup in English gonna be a cup of blue of old of little. I like to see the result of similar language production experiments for those languages and how planning plays in the brain in such contexts.
My name is Dr. Bree Chouinard. I'm from Edmonton, Alberta, where I'm currently working as a postdoc at the University of Alberta. I am a postdoc, and that's what I was doing when I worked on this project. It was one of the first things I worked with Dr. Fish when I started with her as a postdoc. And I'm still with Dr. Fish now at the University of Alberta, doing my postdoc in computing science and kinesiology, although my background is rehabilitation. I got involved with this project by working with Dr. Fish. She was going on leave, and Miriam had already, the other first author, had already written this up as part of her master's dissertation. So it was arranged that Miriam and I would work together while Dr. Fish was on leave to try and propel the project forward into a publication. For me personally, the most valuable part of this project was learning about how machine learning could be applied to neuroimaging data. This has really opened my eyes to the sophisticated kind of information that we can get from neuroimaging data.
My name is Esti Blanco Lorrieta, and I am originally from Bilbao in the Basque Country. I collected the data from this project as a research assistant at New York University Abu Dhabi, and then I finished it as a PhD student at New York University, New York. Currently, I'm a postdoc at the Cognitive Neuropsychology Lab at Harvard University, working with Alfonso Caramazza. And I originally got involved in this project in order to look at the neural basis of simple composition in the original dataset, both in American Sign Language and in English. I think the most valuable part of this project for me has been the collaboration across multiple sites and the ability to use the same dataset that was collected originally with sort of a different focus to be able to inform a different set of questions now. And I think in the time in which we live, where there's a big push for reproducibility and multi-site collaborations, data sharing, etc., I think this project illustrates well how that can work successfully, and it may lead to different interpretations or different questions being asked by using the same data set.
Hi, Alona.
Hi, how are you?
Can you hear me? Yes?
Yeah, I can hear you. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can. Thank you for joining me on this. I know it's Monday morning, tough time to do some kind of a non-essential activity. So I appreciate it. It's a beautiful spring morning in New York. What is it like in Edmonton?
We're having some crazy windstorm and like highways are closed and stuff.
Oh, wow. Actually here too, we've had some very crazy winds. So I don't know what that is about. So
is that your real house? Cause it kind of looks like a background, but it's like
my real house.
Beautiful. It could be a Zoom background.
I saw you were looking outside the window, but actually what I see is a whiteboard, so that's not a whiteboard then.
And this is going to be like not a video, right?
Like yeah, we've started already. So yes, I start right away. There's no warm-up period. We're on.
But are you going to release the video? Or is it
No, I haven't been doing that. Okay, yeah,
because I didn't do my hair.
Yeah, exactly. We can be in our pajamas, so that's totally fine. Anyway, so thanks for jumping in here. I know it's really hard to make time for these kinds of things. I'm kind of thinking of this as one way to just try to slow down. I feel like it's actually kind of healthy to look back on a project after you've finished it, and you know, especially like doing this with a student, it's good practice for them to kind of just talk through a study without any visuals, because that's actually kind of what you do in a job interview. You should be able to talk about your research without pulling out your laptop in order to have some slides. So anyways, it's just kind of like one way to hopefully have a slower pace in the post-pandemic life. So we'll talk about this paper that we published earlier this month. It's a pretty short paper, but the journey behind it is longer. So maybe if you can kind of go through that journey from your perspective. I feel like it's useful for the listener to kind of hear about it. So maybe just quickly before we go into it. So we first met, and actually this is funny because I just looked back on my email. We first met exactly 8 years ago.
Oh, wow.
So I gave a colloquium at your department at CMU. So the Department of Machine Learning, that's actually the department's name. So that was March 28th, 29th, 2013, which is really funny. So this can be like our celebration. Wow. And you were my student host.
Yes,
and then that somehow like started it. So what do you remember?
I think I visited you in New York before that. No?
No.
No?
I'm after
that? Sure.
No. Yeah, I know that you did visit me in New York, but that was not before.
No, okay. Yeah, I didn't look back at my email, so I'll check you on that. So I remember I had started working on adjective noun composition from a semantic representation standpoint, and I had tried to find anybody working on that, and yours was the big name that came up, so I tried to insert myself into your radar and have you come give a talk, which I thought went really well. We had a really diverse crowd of people come out to that talk, which was really cool. Lots of different departments were represented there that day. And then I remember coming to meet you in New York, and actually, like, I don't know if you know this, but I did a job interview. It was for an internship, and like maybe 50% of the reason I did the interview was so that I could go to New York and meet with you and talk to you about what I had been doing. Another 50% was like, sure, fine, I'll interview with that company. But I really wanted to, yeah.
I remember meeting in New York when you were attending a conference, but maybe that's the same thing. We're not going to resolve that right now. I'll trust your memory. So then at some point we shared this data set with you. And this data set, so it's production data, picture naming, and we're decoding the word representations during the planning stage. So from the beginning of picture onset until you actually start talking. And it's actually a pretty old data set that we collected in NYU Abu Dhabi. So Esti Blanco Eloreta, who was our research assistant in Abu Dhabi at the time, collected the data. So she says around 2014, so that was a long time ago. So we've published these data already before our current paper, but even that publication happened much, much after the original data collection, because we actually then decided to combine it with a data set on exactly the same task, but from American Sign Language. And so then we did this collaboration with Karen Emery to do that study, and in some sense held on to the English data so we could then publish it together with the ASL data. I remember the CMU visit really, really well for a couple of reasons. One was because the research group was just so interesting. And there were several of you there at the time that were really doing interesting things. So you were there, Leila Weber was there, Nicole Raffiti was there. And I met with all of you because I just saw the schedule too, because it was in the same email. And I remember that you all had this kind of curiosity about language that I felt was like exceptional in the sort of computational community. Like it seemed like you really wanted to understand, you know, the linguistic properties in a way that was unusual, but also like a really strong group of female students in a computational group. I don't know to what extent you guys were really aware of that. That might've been really special. And now it's been amazing to see how you've all done so well.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think Tom has a history of really investing in women and helping them to be successful. Tom Mitchell, my PhD advisor.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
So that was really cool. It was also a special visit for me because I, for the first 3 years of being in the United States, so from when I was 20 to 23, I was in Pittsburgh because I was an exchange student at Pitt, and then I did my master's there. So that was the first time that I came back to Pittsburgh after having left as a 23-year-old. So it was like a super emotional 24 hours that I was there, because it was really like amazing to be back. But I had to make it really quick, because at that time our son was 2. So then I was still in that stage where like hours are counting. I just need to get that home. But that was a cool visit. And so now you are at the University of Alberta. And so that wasn't your first job. So first you were at UVic in the computer science department, right? That was a single department. And now you have this joint appointment. So it's computer science and psychology. And I have a joint appointment too, linguistics and psychology. So since we both are psychology professors and studied language and the brain, it makes it seem like maybe we're more similar than what we are, but I think backgrounds wise, actually really, really different. And I thought it was interesting how like actually really pushing this paper out reveals like how you actually have to do quite a lot of work to kind of meet in the middle. So maybe I'll kind of summarize the basic design, and then we'll take it from there. So what we're learning is that it's actually reasonably difficult to really convey stimuli and experimental manipulation just in the auditory format. And this study is also very visual, because the stimuli are visual, and then the nature of the data plots is very visual. And so this is going to be our challenge to try to convey it. So the basic experimental design is always picture naming. And the picture that you're naming is always a colored object. Okay. And so I'll walk through the example that we also have in the paper just to keep everything totally consistent. So imagine, for example, a white lamp. So the most natural way to name that is probably white lamp, okay? And that is one of our experimental conditions. And that is what we call the phrase condition. You're naming that that object with its kind of full description that's available from the picture. You name both the color and the the object name lamp. So it's the phrasal condition. And fundamentally, the research question that we're interested in here is exactly how does that phrasal context affect the representations of the individual words? And that's a really hard question to address, but these decoding techniques that are now more and more popular do offer an angle to that. But so now in this design, what's crucial is that phrasal expression is then compared to instances of exactly those words when they are also being planned for language production, but not in the phrasal context. So one way to do that is obviously just name the noun lamp. You can look at exactly the same picture, white lamp, and just say lamp. Or you could just name it as, just name the color. So you could just say white. Okay, so that's great, but there's still a contrast in the number of words that you're planning. So in one case, you're saying white lamp, and in the other cases, you're just saying one word. And so now what's really unique about this design is that there's a condition in which you are actually saying two words, just like in the phrasal condition, and they're actually an adjective and a noun, just like they are in the phrasal condition. But actually in this condition, you're not putting those two words together into a combinatory expression. And so the way we achieved that was to present these colored objects on a colored background. And so there is a condition that we call the list condition, in which you name the background color and then the object shape. So for example, in this stimulus example, the background would be green and the lamp would be white. And so then you go green lamp, a bit of an odd thing to do, but here you're not building a conceptual combination of the green and the lamp. They're not really going together in the same way. So we also don't think you really put it into a phrase, but the superficial sequences is still an adjective and a noun. And so that's really, it's really, really difficult to vary composition while keeping the lexical material constant. And so in this design, it's kind of achieved in a unique way. So this is an MEG data set on this design. The MEG activity is time locked to the beginnings of these, to the onsets of the pictures. And then we go on until the onset of the articulation. And then you did your magic on it. So maybe you can take it from there and say like how exactly how the decoding analysis then worked.
Sure, good. Okay, so then at a high level, decoding is trying to predict something about the stimulus from the recorded brain imaging data. So here, what we were hoping to predict was the word the person, word or words the person was planning to say. And the way we represent the words are with word vectors. So word vectors are just lists of numbers, and those lists of numbers are calculated from a big text corpora, such that similar words should have similar vectors, similar lists of numbers. And then the way we take the here MEG data and we train a regression model that takes as input a particular window of time from the MEG data and predicts as output one of the dimensions of the word vector. And then our word vectors, I think, had 300 dimensions. So we have 300 such models that work in parallel. And so at every time point, at every window, time window, we would take in the EEG data and our 300 models. MEG. Sorry, MEG. I've done a lot of work on EEG recently. MEG data, thank you. And predict the word vector, all 300 dimensions. And then we do what's called the 2-versus-2 test. So we do make two predictions from two MEG images, MEG recordings. And that gives us two predicted word vectors. And we have held out two true word vectors. And then we try to choose the assignment of true to predicted word vector that minimizes the distance between those vectors. If that minimum assignment is the correct assignment, then we get a point. We call that the 2-versus-2 test. And if you average together all the 2-versus-2 tests, you get the 2-versus-2 accuracy. So at a very high level, what that's telling you is just that the prediction is closer to the true word vector than it is to some other random word vector. Mm-hmm. We do all of the possible pairs of words.
Especially for a listener who might be coming more from linguistics and maybe doesn't have computational background or neuroscience background, is there something that we can kind of say to make them understand the nature of the vector representation a little bit more? Like what is the information in that vector representation? Because that's fundamentally like really important in the study because that's what you're decoding. Can you sort of talk a little bit more about what is in that representation?
Good, yeah, so the vectors are created so that similar words are close together, but also it has the interesting property that the direction in the vector space also encodes meaning. So there's some work showing that, for example, you can, the difference between the word man and the word woman, that sort of direction, you can add that direction to the word king and get the word queen sort of idea. But there's also, I'm not sure, I think you were going somewhere in particular. Is there something in particular?
Yeah, so two things. So it captures something about, so the vector comes from the distribution of that word in corpora. Like that's fundamentally in the information that drives the representation. Now a linguist would wonder about things like, okay, does the vector for these stimuli, for example, represent whether the item is a noun or a verb? So the syntactic category, is that somehow part of the representation? And also for a linguist, it's very salient that some semantic properties matter for the grammatical distribution of a word, like the places in the syntax where you can plug that word in. So for example, whether a word is a, or whether a noun is a count noun or a mass noun matters for that. So a mass noun is perfectly happy in the singular, even without a determiner or an article. So I can go buy milk, but I can't go buy lamp. and so that's a semantic property, but it matters for the syntax. Whereas other semantic properties, like say the conceptual specificity of the word. So we've, you know, buried this kind of factor in a lot of our MEG studies. It really matters for the brain, but it doesn't matter for the spots in the sentence, the grammatical locations into which you can put a word. So like boat and canoe, even though boat is the more generic term and canoe is the more specific term, they distribute the same in the syntax. And so those are the kinds of distinctions that you might want. Is like, well, does the vector representation have anything to say about these kinds of distinctions? So can you kind of like contextualize that a little bit?
So the way we build the vector representations is by, there's multiple ways, but one is to predict the context using a neural network. Mm-hmm. And so if you think about words that have to appear in different contexts, they would necessarily have that representation, that encoded in the representation. So if I don't say I'm going to go buy a milk, although we don't have to say that.
Exactly.
But I'm going to go buy a lamp. I have to say a. That would show up in the co-occurrence statistics, so which words I tend to see around a particular word, and that would affect the representations. And we use a window of, I think it's two to four words on each side to build that representation. So we get a little bit of the syntactic, but also semantic representation from the sorts of words that we see nearby.
Mm-hmm. Okay, yeah. Okay, that is important, like exactly how large the surrounding context. So that's always, I feel like, you know, when you come more from the linguist, it's like wrapping your head around the vector representative. I mean, at least that's something that, you know, I always kind of struggle with. So, another important part of the analysis that I especially found important is that I really wanted us to do this, what we call cross-condition decoding. So in order to really understand what is the relationship between the representation of a word in isolation versus in a context, so say the phrasal context, I thought we really should train on the isolated representations and then see how those representations fare in the phrasal contexts. And at least when we started, I felt like I wasn't seeing very much of this kind of cross-condition decoding in the literature to really like try to understand like how well does this representation generalize across context. So what would be like your update on that today? Is it happening more?
It's funny. So when you first suggested that analysis, I remember saying to Miriam at the time, like, just try it. I don't think it'll work. Give it a shot. Let's see what happens. And I was surprised to see that it did work. And it was also a really lovely opportunity for us to try the TGMs. I don't know if you want to talk about that now or later.
Yeah,
later.
But we can do it. Well, yeah.
But the representation, even if you look within the same time window, is still consistent enough across conditions that it shows up, I thought was a really interesting result. It's not something I've seen a lot of. I'm not sure.
Yeah, there's lots and lots of opportunity there, since mm-hmm. especially since, you know, what linguists obsess about is whether two representations really are the same or not. So like in the beginning of this paper, we sort of lead with a very simple example, which has to do with polysemy. So, for example, the word like paper has a super flexible meaning. You can use it in lots of different contexts. Like, you know, you can have a sheet of paper, I'm just referring to the concrete material object, versus like term paper that really refers to the writing. And so So you could apply these kinds of decoding techniques to much more interesting cases from, I mean, this is kind of like the super ding dong case, like, you know, lamp in lamp versus white lamp. But there are many, many, many more linguistically interesting cases where you can ask that kind of, you know, is this representation recoverable from another context, including, say, in more, you know, morphologically complex words, where the degree of semantic transparency of the whole varies wildly. So like a teacher is very transparently a person who teaches. So you could train on teach and find it from teacher, but like header, for example, has the concept of a head, like a lot less transparently. So it's like the opportunities there are really vast if you kind of marry this methodology with kind of linguistics and psycholinguistics. A little bit.
Yeah, it'd be interesting to see the degree to which you might find it in the neural signature, but not in a corpus analysis. You know, like there's sort of like this this idea of head that's not really like the literal head in the header of a paper, for example. And so would that show up in the neural representation, but not in the corpus? I don't know.
Mm-hmm. Empirical question. Theories that would say that yes, that should be the case. So, so that's one kind of generalizability that we investigate. But then we also investigate generalizability of a representation at one point in the processing of a specific stimulus across time. So maybe, and so this is the technique that John Romy King and Stan Dehan published on 2014 paper, something like that. So can you now also teach everybody like the basic concept between the temporal generalization matrices?
Yeah. So the analysis we talked about was training on a particular time window and then testing the regression model that predicts the reductor on the same time window. So that tells you for a held out brain image, for a held out MEG sample, is the representation consistent across the samples? So across the different times a person saw a particular picture. But we might also want to ask, if we vary the time, is the representation also consistent? So if we train at a particular time window, say around 100 milliseconds, and then test at another time window, say 300 milliseconds, is the regression model that was trained at 100 milliseconds able to predict the word vector if we use MEG data from 300 milliseconds at test time? So the regression model is trained with data from a particular time period, so it learns the patterns that are pertinent. For that particular time period, but then we test it in a different time period. And so if it can still perform with statistically significant accuracy, that means that there was a milliseconds.
Yeah, the audio was a little choppy, so hopefully I can salvage it.
Yeah, sorry.
So then if we kind of think about it from a cognitive perspective, the question that you're able to address is whether, you know, like I've just seen the picture and there's some representation that's active like very briefly after the onset of the picture, we can ask, is it the case that, you know, that representation continues to be transformed kind of to the next level of representation? So obviously your goal is a motor output. And so you can imagine like, well, I have the semantic representation, which I'm then gonna turn into a lexical representation, to a morphological representation. And then maybe there would be no temporal generalizability because the representation, although you can continue to decode the representation, it's actually a slightly different one as it evolves versus a situation in which you have a certain representation active, say at the beginning, and then you somehow like continue to use that representation or stays active. And so then I think that's one of the main findings of the paper is that that is what we found for the nouns in the phrases.
Yeah, that representation is strong and also sustained over time, that it's very consistent across time. Which, yeah, definitely a really interesting.
Yeah. Versus the adjectives.
Right, which were just there and then gone, basically.
Yeah, so very robust contrast for the for the nouns and the adjectives.
Yeah, so talk about what that looks like on the TGM. So if the representation is changing over time, things would not generalize across time. And so we the TGM is actually like a square. And so if it doesn't generalize along across time, all we see is a above chance accuracy rate on that diagonal, because the only time it works to train and test is if the windows are close together. But if there's generalization, then we would see off the diagonal, we would see some above chance squares, because we train, remember, we're training at 100 milliseconds and testing at 300 milliseconds. So that would put us pretty far off the diagonal. We would see a block there that was above chance because that representation was consistent across the two time windows.
Mm-hmm. And it really was only for the nouns in phrases where we saw that yeah. behavior. And so interestingly, even when the nouns were in isolation, that didn't happen, none of the other cases. So it really seemed that when you're planning a noun in a phrasal context, you continue to use that noun representation for a long time, but in none of the other cases do you do that. But then we should also just make clear that the noun versus adjective difference was not only a difference in the phrasal context. So nouns and adjectives were just different, period, right? Mm-hmm. So yeah. Noun representations seem to be more decodable.
And consistent across time, yeah, definitely. Which is interesting because when you think of the phrases, adjective, noun, it would seem like you would need to keep both of them in your mind to create the utterance, but somehow that noun gets some special treatment and it's sort of more robust and more consistent across time and sustained for longer. It's just interesting.
Yeah. So I think that was something like the robustness of that contrast was sort of a surprise to all of us, even though at the outset, like if you sort of like, oh, we're going to be, you know, studying the neural representation of adjective modifiers and nouns, you would just like, well, okay, the nouns might be like more important and more strongly represented because that's the head of the phrase and the adjective is just some innocent modifier. You can drop it and still like put the noun into the same syntactic context. But something about the fact that in this particular design, like the lexical domain was just like so mundane. It's like a pretty boring setup. So just, so let me actually list to the specific stimuli so everyone can kind of have an idea of exactly what the words were. So the nouns that we used were just six nouns. So bag, bell, cane, lamp, and plane, as an airplane. And then the colors were black, brown, green, red, and white. And this lexical material is like very oversaturated in the context of the experiment because like it's constantly repeated. And so all those properties, the fact that everything is like a, you know, concrete object, everything's, you know, obviously super imageable, very repeated. You think that it could easily just like flatten out any differences, but it didn't. And so it sort of suggests that, you know, perhaps there's a more fundamental difference between the nouns and the adjectives, and we sort of walk through a few possibilities of what might drive that in the discussion. Like nouns have a more multi-sensory, these noun meanings have a more multi-sensory aspect to them. So, you know, you can see the object, you can feel it, and, you know, maybe you can imagine a noise that it would make, whereas these color adjectives, although you can have the color concept, your experience, your sensory experience is necessarily visual. And there's some interesting work from Marina Bednis' group actually that shows that many types of concepts are kind of shared between the sighted and the blind, but color representations really are different. So, you know, for anyone who's kind of interested in delving into that more, we talk about that a little bit in the discussion. Is there, since you had studied noun adjective composition in comprehension before, have you had a chance to think about that relationship at all? Like, for example, did you see this kind of asymmetry in the comprehension work?
That was interesting. So because it's comprehension, what we saw was, so in its English, so it's adjective followed by noun. We saw this peak in the representation of the adjective when the adjective is appears on the screen, and the same for the noun when the noun appears on the screen. But because you have to remember the adjective through the time you read the noun, what we saw was sustained activity for the adjective over time. Yeah, which was, it's sort of like in some ways, it's sort of the opposite here. Like you see the noun and the adjective basically at the same time, but then you have to remember that noun during the time you're producing the adjective, right? And so it sort of flips it on its head, which is interesting. It's sort of a backwards way to.
Yeah, that's interesting. Yeah, we should have said something about that in the discussion. Right, so you're like in comprehension, if you go white lamp and then you have to perform some task, you're computing with white during a lamp. Whereas in our task, you see the picture of a white lamp, so you get all the information at the same time. The first thing in English that you're gonna say is lamp is white, and then so you have to remember what the noun was as well. And so then you're maintaining that representation as you're waiting to actually be able to articulate it. So now that's a very clear hypothesis about what drives the contrast, and very straightforwardly testable with a language that has the opposite word order, which there are many such languages.
We started collecting data in Portuguese, actually in Pittsburgh. Portuguese bilingual, so we collected English and them reading English and Portuguese, but we only got 3 participants, and now we can't collect any more data. Although hopefully that will be opening up again soon, so that would be exciting.
We in Abu Dhabi we are very much like resuming data collection right now, and I do have variants of these tasks in different languages. I'm not running exactly this variant, which honestly is the one that controls for the lexical material absolutely in the nicest way. That's really hard to achieve in a different way.
That's what we were finding when we translated the exact study I did, the 2019 paper of mine. We translated it exactly to Portuguese. There's problems with like gender. There's big problems.
Complicated quickly. Yeah. But that is the nice thing about production, in that at least you can keep the physical stimulus constant between languages. And that's obviously something that I've really leveraged, especially with the sign language study, where even the modality of the production is different, but at least the physical stimulus that's presented to the subject stays constant. So you brought up the question of kind of controlled experiments versus naturalistic experiments as approaches for tackling these kinds of questions. So maybe I can throw that to you as kind of our final topic. So now, having kind of done this type of study a few times, so I think you've mostly done these more controlled studies, right? And kind of appreciating what you can learn in that way. So what are your thoughts about the possibilities of getting similar results or insights from the naturalistic method?
So I think back to a sort of anecdote I had heard about when they were like learning to study DNA and gene expression, and they had noticed that there was a lot of what looked like genes but weren't being expressed in the yeast that they were keeping in their petri dishes. And like, that's funny, what are these genes for? They must not be for anything. But it actually turns out that they were genes that were required for living in more stressful environments. So if they had to like use alternate food sources or create their own something somethings, I don't know, whatever yeast do, then those genes would be used. And so it's sort of like if you study something in a very controlled environment, sometimes you don't get the whole story. And so I think that would be the power of moving to a more naturalistic experimental design, where people are listening to stories or reading stories. I think that opens up a different sort of view onto what language looks like in the brain. But of course, it comes with a whole bunch of other problems that more controlled experiments help with. I mean, and that's the beauty of the work that you do, is that So much of it is controlled that you can very clearly see where the differences are and attribute those the differences you see in the neural signature to those exact differences in the stimuli. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think the combination is really important. So I would take it for granted that, you know, from the very, very limited small studies, you get a limited small window, but maybe one that is a little bit more understandable, like mm-hmm. at least you maybe understand the small thing with, you know, slightly more detail. But I've always been very interested in the naturalistic method. And, you know, when John Brennan he was one of my first graduate students, the work that we did with naturalistic stimuli was at the time, the first work where we really tagged the stimulus. Like people had used a naturalistic stimulus, say in fMRI or PET, as the stimulus in a block design, and then kind of like looking at like responses to a narrative versus a list of words or something like that. But in collaboration with my vision colleagues in the psychology department, who had just like collected some language data, and they kind of brought it to me and say like, well, here is like the fMRI activity to Alice in Wonderland. What should we do with it? And so then I was like, well, if we're going to do anything with it, we're going to have to tag the stimulus and somehow name the stimulus. And so I guess for me personally, the contrast very much boils down to the fact that when you're designing experiments, you can kind of do anything. Like there's a lot of creativity that you can throw at experimental design, and maybe this is just like my bias, I'm not a computational person by any measure by my training, but then so you can really create the contrast and kind of study whatever you want and discover therefore whatever you want. With the naturalistic method, the way I see it working is that people have their text or their audiobook, whatever it is. And then you apply kind of on the shelf computational models on it. So then it's like, okay, well, what are the ways in which we can tag the stimulus? And you see the options that are out there in the literature and you use those and do model comparison. And so that is different from like really like being every time able to innovate the model. Like, I think that's just like too much work because the model has to set so many different parameters at once. I don't know, does this make any sense to you? Like as a contrast? So what I would like to see is like, okay, here's the computational model. It fits the data, you know, in X way, to a certain degree. And then you try to make it better so that it continues to fit the data better. But this I feel like is not the name of the game for a lot of people.
Yeah, that's interesting. We have the problem that if we make a model more complex, then it does fit the data better just by sort of definition. So you have to think of a way to.
Yeah, you have to make sure that it's not just because of that. Yeah.
Fit the model in a way that takes into that into account, which there are ways of taking that into account.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but yeah, I'm always thinking about how exactly
what's better.
The routine would be, but then we sort of talk about it somewhat informally and a lot of the work. Although I have a computational postdoc in Abu Dhabi who is doing interesting work. So
yeah,
we'll be hearing from her. All right. I think we need to move on to the rest of our Mondays. But I appreciate it. Yeah. Congrats to us for taking us to the finish line, and I'll share more data with you anytime. So.
Yeah, great. Yeah,
tell me where to drop it.
This was a long time coming, so I'm so glad that we finished something together.
Yeah, and it was a pure. I mean, I think we did all of the writing during the pandemic with like all of our children running around. So yes. Yeah, so extra cheers to that.
Yes, good. Yeah.
All right.
Okay. Thanks.
Nice to see you later. Bye.
And that is a wrap from NELAB Spotlight.